Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was good!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. Time to go into the vault for an older episode of the show. This one originally published on, This is August 6th, 2020. This is our episode on Pycrete. This was a good one. I think it generated a lot of listener mail, and it was a load of fun.
All right, let's jump right in.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're going to be talking about materials today, but this is a really fun materials episode that will shatter like glass in our hands, or will it? I guess it's a big question mark.
Yeah, we're going to be talking a lot about ice, but a lot of exciting stuff about ice. You're going to learn some new things about ice, I think, and you're also going to think a bit more deeply about what can be done and also what perhaps cannot or should not be done with ice. So if you've read any of George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, if you've read that saga, or if you've viewed the TV adaptation Game of Thrones, you're well acquainted with the Wall. But to reacquaint everybody, this is a fantasy world that's based on sort of a medieval European model. And in the far north, you have this massive 300-mile-long, 700-foot-tall wall of ice that we're told has stood there for 8,000 years as a barrier against the peoples and the supernatural horrors of the far north.
Yeah, it's basically Hadrian's Wall, except much bigger and made of magic.
Yes. Yeah, we're told it was built by Brandon the Builder with the aid of giants and the magical children of the forest. So we're definitely to understand that there is actual magic in its construction. But also there's this idea that Brandon was a master engineer, that he's in the vein of these various engineering cultural heroes that you see in various cultures.
But of course, the real standout feature that makes this wall unique is that it is built out of ice, not out of stone, but out of frozen water.
Yes, it is a wall of ice. So, ignoring the magic for a second here, it sounds like a great plan, right? I mean, humans have been known to make shelters out of ice. Glaciers and snow have served as natural barriers to travel. So why wouldn't it be ideal to construct this far northern barrier, which is going to be dealing with, with far northern climate? Why not build it out of ice?
Good question. Is a block of ice not just as good as a stone brick?
Yeah. So I was looking around about this, and fortunately, there is already a great book out there that dives into this very question. It's titled Fire, Ice, and Physics, The Science of Game of Thrones by Rebecca C. Thompson, Ph.D., a physicist and author of the popular Spectra series of comic books about physics. And I should also note that Sean Carroll wrote the intro.
Cool.
So she, first of all, this is just a really fun book. If you if you're interested in Game of Thrones and science, I encourage you to pick it up. I love books like this. You know, I have one about Dune. I've been eyeing one about Star Wars. But she goes through various aspects of the books and the world of Westeros and breaks them about scientifically, and does so in a very engaging, humorous, but also Westeros loving style.
Okay.
So there's one section in there where she tackles the wall. And she points out that ultimately this question, would an ice wall work, is a lot more complex than you might think. Mm-hmm. So for starters, there's not just one type of ice crystal. There are 17 types of crystalline ice that we know of, plus there are three different types of amorphous ice. And theoretically, she says there might be as many as 300 different phases of ice, depending on some of the research out there.
Right. The different phases of ice having different physical properties is something that's been explored in science fiction for a while, actually. It's in the novel Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut, which invents a fictional phase of ice. There is no actual phase of ice that does this, but there's a fictional phase of ice called Ice Nine, which acts as a seed crystal, and it's a doomsday weapon, because if you drop a piece of this ice into regular water, it will rearrange the structure of the regular water so that it freezes at room temperature, basically killing Earth.
I've never read Cat's Cradle, but I remember, now that you mentioned it, I remember like reading that on a summary or the back of the paperback or something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But to clarify again, that's a fictional phase of ice. There is no actual phase of ice that does that we know about.
Yeah, the phase of ice we're most familiar with is Ice 1H, also known as Ice Phase 1. And this is the hexagonal crystal form of ordinary ice. And this is pretty much all the ice you ever come into contact with. And therefore, we can assume that this is the same ice that we encounter in the world of Westeros.
I think that's a safe assumption.
Yeah. Of course, you might say, well, what if it's not? What if somehow this is an alternate universe or a different planet where another form of ice is the predominant phase? I'm not sure if that's even a reasonable question to raise, though. Anyway, Thompson does a great overview of ice and the physical properties of ice. And I do want to throw in that she has an excellent bit where she weighs in on whiskey stones.
Oh, okay. So, Robert, explain the concept of a whiskey stone real quick.
Well, I do not own these, but I assume you do not either. But I've heard of them, I guess. I don't know if I know anyone. I think I might know one person who has them. But the idea is that you're such an aficionado of bourbon or whiskey, and you don't want anything to dilute it. You want it cold, but you don't want to put some ice in there, which will chill the drink, but also melt. So apparently these have been marketed before. The whiskey stones are rocks that somebody sells you, rocks that you keep in your freezer. And then when you want to have a cold glass of brown alcohol, you put the cold rock in there. And the rock, of course, will not melt and dilute your beverage.
Now, if you actually enjoy whiskey stones, no judgment at all, more power to you. But I would like to point out just real quickly that this is, you can get into how it might be a little bit misguided from a physics standpoint, but it's also a little bit misguided, I think, from a culinary standpoint, because I mean, I think most people believe that like whiskeys tend to kind of improve with the addition of a small amount of water. So like melting ice cools, but also adds water to the drink. And this is an important part of many spirit and cocktail preparations. And this might be why, if you've ever tried to mix a cocktail that is supposed to be shaken with ice, but then you make it without shaking it with ice, it kind of tastes wrong. And that's because one of the ingredients in this cocktail is actually water, and you have left that important ingredient out by not shaking it with ice that dilutes into the drink.
Yeah, I've definitely experienced this making cocktails before, where I'll end up, for whatever reason, you know, due to whatever kind of ice I have on hand, I'll end up with a drink that doesn't taste perfect. But once the ice has melted a little bit, it's a different experience.
Totally.
And even with like a straight whiskey on the rocks, I mean, that's always been my experience of that. It's like the drink will change as the drinking experience will change as the ice melts, which I think is part of the experience. But then again, I'm I'm ultimately a novice when it comes to the appreciation of fine whiskeys.
But Thompson also makes a physics point about the whiskey stones, right?
Right. She writes the following, quote, "The heat from the soda is used to melt the ice so the surrounding soda cools off. This is also why whiskey stones are a total sham. Seriously, I can't stress this enough. Don't buy whiskey stones. If you want to keep your drink cold without watering it down, get yourself some water-filled plastic ice cubes. They're 80% less stylish, but 100% more useful." Now, she continues from here and gives some more detail. But basically, her point is that the whiskey stone will only take away enough energy to raise its temperature to the whiskey temperature. An ice cube will take the same energy plus the energy needed to break the molecular bonds, which melts the ice.
Right. That phase transition takes energy the same way that boiling water takes energy. Like, why does your pot of water boiling on the stove not just keep increasing in temperature until it's the same temperature as like the heating element below it? It's because it takes enormous energy to turn that water into steam, and that energy gets boiled off.
Yeah. So anyway, that doesn't directly relate to the building of a giant wall made out of ice, but it was just too interesting, and her writing on it was just too humorous to pass over.
Well, let's get back to why exactly it is that ice is not a good building material.
All right. Well, she points out that, quote, "ice on a large scale is basically ketchup." So ice on a large scale is a non-Newtonian fluid. In an ice wall or a glacier, the pressure of the structure's own weight causes it to creep. And this would occur even if low temperatures prevented the ice from ever really melting. Dislocations, small cracks that cause ice crystals to move over each other would cause the creep, even in a pretty stable, chilly environment. So this would be in play concerning the wall along with temperature changes.
Yeah, that's right. And creep actually is the technical term there. It comes up in a paper by a chemist that we're going to look at later in the episode.
She says that ultimately the wall would have probably been okay for like a year, but over the course of thousands of years, it would end up being just more of an ice dome or a plateau, depending on the temperature. So it would be far less of an obstacle to certainly intelligent beings looking to invade the South.
Well, good thing it's magic then.
but there's more. There's another huge issue, and one that's key to the rest of the episode here. Ice tends to have a lot of defects in it due to the way the ice crystals are organized, and this leads to cracks. And of course, cracks mean that the ice can ultimately fail, right? Mm-hmm. It can ultimately lose its structural integrity. And it's not just that the ice fails. All materials can fail, and we have to understand how they fail and what conditions cause them to fail. But with ice, quote, "there's no specific set of conditions that cause ice to fail. Rather, it fails under a wide range of conditions."
Yes. Another way of putting this is that ice is structurally unpredictable. You take two blocks of ice that are the same size, made of the same water, and one might fail trying to hold up 5 pounds, while another one can hold up 20 pounds. And that kind of difference, that variability, is not a good characteristic of a building material. You could almost argue, I think, that predictability is more important than strength when you're selecting a building material.
Yes. Now, Thompson does point out that there are ways to strengthen the ice. There are ways to make it more dependable, more durable. And the interesting thing is the weird things that you do to ice to do this. We find fantastic examples of this, not in a fantasy world like Game of Thrones. But instead, we find these examples in the equally or perhaps even more bizarre world of our own real history.
Right. This brings us to the subject of the rest of today's episode, which is going to be this fantastic frozen material known as picrete, or ice that's about as strong as concrete.
Yes. And again, let me just say that if you're familiar with this material and its usage and the project we're going to talk about, then you know you're in for an exciting time. But if you haven't, just let me assure you that everything is about to get far stranger than a giant wall of ice made to keep undead invaders out.
Right. We're more in the realm of a giant tub of ice used to bomb Nazis.
But first, we're going to have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more ice.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone, this is Molly and Matt, and we're the hosts of Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult, a podcast from Ruby Studio and iHeart Podcasts.
It's a show dedicated to helping you figure out the trickiest parts of adulting.
Like how to start planning for retirement, creating a healthy skincare routine, understanding when and how much to tip someone, and so much more.
Here's a clip from an upcoming episode featuring the weekly home checks, Keyshawn Lane, that you won't want to miss.
A common mistake that a lot of people do, they use fabric softener when it's not so great for your clothes.
Should we never be using fabric softener?
No, you should not ever be using fabric softener.
Wow.
It leaves a deposit on our clothes, which is also left in the machine. And it also makes the clothes highly flammable.
Wait, what?
Yes. What you want to do instead is just use a quarter cup of vinegar.
And that'll make them softer?
That'll make them softer. And if you wanted some kind of scent, you can use essential oils.
Wow, wow, wow. Catch new episodes of Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult every other Tuesday on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Grown Up Stuff.
All right, we're back. So we're going to be dealing with the Second World War here, a truly global war that worked kind of like a black hole, just pulling in, I mean, first and foremost, human lives, but also human ingenuity and, of course, funds and resources as well. So there was more than enough room in all of this for the occasional harebrained scheme to pick up a lot of steam. And this is one of them.
I want to say, I'm not sure exactly how harebrained it is. Like, in some ways it's harebrained, and in other ways it's quite ingenious. It's this strange mixture of genuine insight and good ideas with proposals so outlandish they're laughable in their face.
Yes. Yeah. I should rephrase, I guess, that there are better examples of purely harebrained schemes that were brought up during World War II. This one, I guess it's just more of an idea that this is a real outside the box idea, and one that, at least for a while, seemed like it might be the best solution to the problem, given the resources at hand and the weight of the circumstances.
Right. So what was the problem that we're going to start with here?
Well, the basic problem is the Allied forces needed better aerial coverage of the North Atlantic.
Yeah. So to expand on this, I want to refer to a paper that we're going to be consulting extensively for the rest of this episode. It's called A Description of the Iceberg Aircraft Carrier and the Bearing of the Mechanical Properties of Frozen Wood Pulp Upon Some Problems of Glacier Flow. This is a report that was presented to a scientific organization called the International Glaciological Society in 1946, and it was written by a guy named Max Perutz. Now, Max Perutz lived from 1914 until 2002. He was an Austrian-born chemist and molecular biologist, and generally just an extremely accomplished scientist. He won the 1962 Nobel Prize for Chemistry, and this was for his work on the structure of hemoglobin. But Perutz was really just one of the great pioneers of molecular biology. I was listening to an interview between Brian Cox and the molecular biologist Venki Ramakrishnan, who was talking about Perutz's work explaining the structure of proteins. And Ramakrishnan says that in many ways, modern biology would be unthinkable without Perutz's contributions. He did some of the most important pioneering work for the kinds of molecular biology that are, you know, ubiquitous throughout the biology research and biotech world today. But before all this, Perutz was involved in the British war effort during World War II. And specifically, he was working with the ice-based technology that we are discussing today. And in this paper, he gives a firsthand account of the project and some scientific discoveries that came out of it. So to establish the problem, Perutz writes that in the autumn of 1942, Allied leadership recognized that their war effort was really suffering from a lack of air power range, especially in response to German U-boat attacks in the Atlantic. And this was affecting the transport of cargo across the ocean between Great Britain and their allies in North America. So there's a U-boat threat throughout the ocean. You never know if your cargo resupply ships are going to be attacked, and you could defend them if you had better air coverage. But how are you going to get planes all the way out there in the middle of the Atlantic where the U-boats can attack?
That's right. You come down to the limits of aviation technology at that time.
Yeah. And Perutz writes, quote, "It had been a common experience that the carrier-based aircraft of the Allies were inferior in armament and speed to the land-based planes of the enemy." And so what he's talking about was that there were aircraft carriers that the Allies had during World War II, but these aircraft carriers at the time were relatively small, with short runways and limited parking and storage space. So the kinds of planes that could take off from them tended to have light armor and wings that would like collapse and fold up to make them easier to store. The kinds of planes that were better armored, more powerful, and could do more damage, for example, I was reading an article by Paul Collins from 2002 in the magazine Cabinet about this project. And Collins mentioned Spitfires and bomber planes as examples of these more powerful planes. They couldn't fit on or take off from aircraft carriers. They had to be launched from the ground. And this didn't only affect cargo transport and other operations in the Atlantic. It also had implications for future ground invasions of Axis-occupied areas in, say, continental Europe and in Asia. So, you know, given the existing limitations on aircraft carriers, if you were to try to land on a distant shore, Your air power inland would be limited until you could capture or establish airfields there from which you could launch these more powerful land-based planes like Spitfires and bombers. And so Perutz writes, quote, "It was only natural, therefore, that a proposal for the apparently cheap construction of gigantic aircraft carriers capable of operating land-based aircraft thousands of miles from their base was seriously considered." So that's the dilemma they're in. They're trying to get more powerful, bigger planes farther out into the ocean, farther from home.
Right. And that's a pretty tall order right there. But then on top of that, not only does it have to be enormous and also inexpensive, it also would really help if it were essentially torpedo-proof, if all these prowling U-boats would be incapable of sinking it.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to load a ship up with all of your most important, most expensive aircraft and then launch it out into the ocean to be sunk by a U-boat.
Yeah. So, in defense of everything that comes after this, that's a tall order that really invites outside the box thinking.
Right. And fortunately, we had an outside the box thinker come onto the scene.
Yes. Enter English journalist turned inventor Geoffrey Pike, who lived 1893 through 1948.
Yeah. And so Paul Collins, writing for that Cabinet magazine article I mentioned from 2002, he quotes the Times of London calling Pike, quote, "one of the most original, if unrecognized, figures of the present century." And I just want to read Collins' brief summary of Pike's early life. Quote, "His career began in 1914 when, as a teenager at Cambridge University, he landed a foreign correspondent job by using a false passport to sneak into wartime Germany. After getting tossed into a concentration camp, he fled the country in a daring daytime escape. In the 1920s, he virtually created progressive elementary education in Great Britain, all for the sake of his own son's education. Pike financed his own school by brilliantly riding futures markets and controlling a quarter of the world's supply of tin, a ploy which brought him to financial ruin in 1929. He lived on as an eccentric hermit, publishing prescient warnings of Nazism and proposing one of the first media watchdogs. After the war, his freelance genius helped propel the creation of the National Health Service."
That's quite a resume.
So, yeah, foreign journalist, escaped enemy capture, weird investment portfolio, huge into tin, loses it all, eccentric hermit, but then pioneers progressive political causes. And Pike was known for having some extremely weird, you could say, outside the box ideas. One that I was just briefly reading about was that in 1943, as a proposal for the war effort, Geoffrey Pike got pipe fever and he started thinking, we need more pipes. We can transport things and people through pipes. And that's way more efficient than trying to transport them just straightforwardly over land and vehicles and all that. So he proposed the idea of transporting goods and soldiers like from ship at shore to deep inside enemy territory through pipes. And obviously this would have some drawbacks, especially when you're trying to ship people through pipes. But in order to combat claustrophobia and suffocation, the troops that were sent through the pipe could be supplied with barbiturates and oxygen tanks.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite an alternate reality to try and envision, one in which you would have basically like hot and cold running armed reinforcements.
Right. Yeah. So during World War II, the British military established an office known as Combined Operations, and this was to coordinate actions that required the cooperation of multiple branches of the armed forces. So if you needed to combine naval and air forces or army, etc. And in 1942, the chief of Combined Operations was this guy named Lord Lewis Mountbatten. Lord Mountbatten is a big figure in 20th century British history. He's sort of all over the place. But Collins writes that Pike presented himself to Mountbatten's Office of Combined Operations, and he basically told him, hey, you need to hire me, quote, because I'm a man who thinks. And so Pike was thinking, and he came up with an idea, a response to this problem of limited air power range in the Atlantic and elsewhere.
That's right. In October of 1942, Pike said, hey, why don't we get an iceberg, hollow it out, and use that as a floating base? Because this would, it would float, it would It would be torpedo proof, and it would certainly last long enough for us to then establish better land bases.
Right. So the idea was that a platform capable of launching bigger, heavier planes like bombers and Spitfires could be made out of ice. And there were two approaches to this, actually. So one is the naturalistic approach, where you just take an existing iceberg and you kind of plane it down and flatten the surface and create a runway. The other would be to create from scratch a giant barge made of ice. But in general, Pike saw a lot of potential for ice-based technology, since he claimed that manufacturing ice, even if you're going to make it yourself, needed only 1% of the energy required to create the same amount of steel.
Right, which I mean, that's playing into the energy demands, but also just in general, you have a global war going on. Your, you know, resources like steel and even wood, like those are pretty much all already being contested. You know, like those are needed to build airplanes, to build traditional ships, munitions, etc. So if you have a solution that requires less energy and none of the steel that it needs to be used by all these other parts of the war, then you have a potentially amazing solution on your hands.
Yeah, it would be hugely advantageous if you could make something like this work. And as you already mentioned, ice naturally floats. It just automatically floats in water. And this is because it's less dense than liquid water. I think about 9% less dense. Also, ice is fairly resistant to explosives. They'd observed this just through the fact that icebergs that already existed were surprisingly resilient against shelling by ships.
Yeah, I saw that tidbit brought up as well, and I didn't have time to explore further, but of course that just illustrates that warships are firing, or at least were firing, at icebergs just for fun, or for maybe for target practice.
I do. Yeah, I wonder what the reason was. Why were they just trying it out?
Yeah.
Maybe the iceberg was in the form of a lewd gesture. They got kind of offended.
Maybe so. And by the way, about the idea of it being resistant to explosives, I believe we're going to come back around to some more specific stats on
yes.
that later.
Ice was believed to be relatively resistant to explosives at the time, but it turns out I think that it's more variable than that.
One quick thing about ice floating. Thompson briefly mentions this, like this being a key attribute of ice, because imagine what would the shape of life on Earth if ice was heavier than liquid water, if ice formed at the bottom of the sea. That would just be a disastrous blow to life as we know it. Like imagine how organisms would function or would fail to function in such an environment.
Well, yeah, I've read about this before also, that the fact that ice floats on water and means that ice forms over the top of, say, bodies of fresh water that freeze in the winter, or even, you know, I guess over at the polar ice caps, that protects the water below from continuous freezing and exposure to the elements above. So the fact that it floats allows life to continue in water in very cold places.
And also it means you might be able to make a giant aircraft carrier out of it.
Right. Exactly. So this is something from Collins here. Pike's dream became this hypothetical ice-based ship that would be known as the HMS Habakkuk. So I just want to read from Collins a little bit on the size here. It would be constructed from, quote, 40-foot blocks of ice. His Habakkuk would be 2,000 feet long, 300 feet wide, with walls 40 feet thick. Its interior would easily accommodate 200 Spitfires. The largest ship then afloat was the HMS Queen Mary, which weighed in at 86,000 tons. The Habakkuk would weigh 2 million tons.
Wow.
That's a big boat. And strangely enough, it looks like leadership kind of went for it. Now, there would be some obvious problems with a boat that size. I mean, we can get into more of them as we go on. One of them that was mentioned in Collins's article was that, of course, you'd have a problem with a boat like this, getting advantage, sneaking up on anything. It would probably be kind of slow moving, hard to steer, all of that stuff. But in response to that idea, apparently Pike said, quote, surprise can be obtained from permanence as well as suddenness.
I like that.
I'm not sure I fully get that, but okay. I'm like halfway there.
So anyway, this idea definitely made it up the chain. Winston Churchill thought it sounded promising. And according to Perutz in that 46 paper that we referenced earlier, Churchill thought that while it should be a high priority, he also thought that they should, quote, let nature do the work. So in other words, let's maybe not build something out of ice. Let's see what we can do. We can do making taking advantage of what's already there. And in this, this sounds like a like classic boss thinking.
Oh,
like,
totally.
This is a great idea, but let's go towards the cheap version of the idea. I like that you brought me the expensive version too, but I really like that cheap version.
Yeah, exactly. Let nature do the work. And I've got a great story about Churchill coming up in a minute. But just to expand on Pike's thinking, this is a great section from Collins. Quote, in battle, the ice ships could put their onboard refrigeration systems to good use by spraying supercooled water at enemy ships, icing their hatches shut, clogging their guns, and freezing hapless sailors to death.
Oh, man. In this, Pike essentially sounds like Mr. Freeze from the 60s Batman TV show.
Is it more from the 60s Batman or from Batman the Animated Series?
I would say it sounds... It's either the Arnold Schwarzenegger Mr. Freeze or the TV show Mr. Freeze. I feel like animated Mr. Freeze was like was the ideal balance. Like that's my Mr. Freeze.
That's a good and, Mr. Freeze. Yeah.
Yeah, that was solid. Whereas if you're talking about something ridiculous, you got to go 60s or you got to go Arnold.
So Pike presents his idea for a 2 million ton aircraft carrier made out of ice, and Churchill is like, ice try.
You know, one of the just crazy things about this is, first of all, this is not something that just came out. Like, clearly this idea has been public knowledge since at least since the 1940s, right? Mm-hmm. Since 46 when that paper came out. And yet I feel like any like weird alternate history book, or you know, that say if it's the Golden Compass or something by Alan Moore, for instance, if someone had said, ooh, I really like this alternate version of reality you got going here, but why don't you throw in a giant aircraft carrier made out of ice that also shoots freezing water at other ships? Put that in there. They would say, no, that's just too far. That's just too silly. I'm not trying to create a farce here.
That's going to be in some Kevin Costner movie of the future. It's like in the water world and the Postman tradition.
Yeah. Or I guess I feel like there has to be some sci-fi or fantasy out there that has really latched onto this idea. But I almost feel like it's such a weird idea. It's got to be the idea you lead with, you know, like everything has to be built around the ice ships of, Thebes or whatever the your world happens to be.
Yeah. And so unfortunately, this idea, as amazing as it is, ran into some problems in the real world.
Yeah. Ultimately, the Berg ship never came to be because for a few different reasons. One of the big ones, though, was that icebergs didn't rise high enough above the waterline, and ice floes were too thin, because that was another idea, right? You go get some ice floes, cut yourself out as the amount that you needed, and use that as the basis for your ship.
Right. Tow them down from the Arctic.
Yeah. And then also further research into, the matters concerning the feasibility of constructing an ice-based carrier turned up some of the challenges, the material challenges we've discussed already.
Yeah. To go into a little more detail on that. So you mentioned the fact that natural ice just tends to not come out of the water high enough when it's floating in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Perutz talks about how the fleet air arm had figured out that in order to have a working aircraft carrier that planes could actually land on and take off from, you gotta have a freeboard, what's called a freeboard, of at least 15 meters or about 50 feet above the water. And the freeboard is just the height of a ship's deck above the waterline.
Yeah, if you've ever seen a real aircraft carrier, you'll notice it rides pretty high.
And this is what you're talking about with ice floes being too thin. Like, the natural ice floes are just not tall enough. They're not going to do the job.
Right.
So engineers were given the job of, well, okay, we got to construct a man-made aircraft carrier platform of ice. But there was a sort of dearth of knowledge about exactly what you could do with ice as a building material. Pre-existing research on the structural properties of ice was sort of all over the place with its findings. So experiments were carried out in Britain and in Canada to try to sort these claims out. They did a bunch of mechanical strength test results, and actually we learned a lot about ice. But part of what they learned is that the way ice responds is, in fact, highly variable and unpredictable. Like, the way it responds to explosives is kind of unpredictable. Sometimes it's kind of resilient, sometimes it gets obliterated.
Right. And you can't just latch on to the results that you like.
Right.
Especially not when you're going to try and carry out a project like this.
Right. And so there was another thing they were testing for, which was the modulus of rupture for ice. This is also known as flexural strength or bend strength. Imagine a very simple test. You have like two supports and you put a slab of a material on those two supports, and then you put a weight pressing down in the middle between the two supports. And for any given material, you see how much weight a slab of it can sustain of pressure. And Perutz writes that, quote, the average modulus of rupture of ice beams in bending, for instance, was found to be about 22.5 kilograms per square centimeter. But individual beams sometimes failed at stresses as low as 4.9 kilograms per square centimeter. And this is not good. Perutz points out that just regular old pine lumber has a modulus of rupture somewhere around 800 kilograms. So way better in general. And again, the ice is somewhat variable. You might get a weak beam of ice here or there, and you wouldn't even know it until you press on it.
Right. If you're going to build something out of this, if you're going to design something built out of this this material, you need to know how far you can push it, and it needs to be at least a dependable range and not just a roll of the dice.
Exactly. So ice is just really not sound as a large load-bearing building material. And so this leaves us around February of 1943 with ice looking like a bad candidate to build an aircraft carrier out of.
That's right. Things looked pretty bleak, at least until they read the work of Herman Mark and Walter P. Hohenstein.
Yeah, and these guys were working out of Brooklyn Polytechnic.
Yeah, and they'd been experimenting with frozen water with wood pulp inside it. And they found that the resulting material, like essentially the mixture of frozen water and wood pulp, was stronger than ice.
Significantly stronger. Apparently, Herman Mark had formerly been Perutz's teacher at some point, and I found an account of the discovery written by Perutz and quoted in a piece for Chemistry World by Kit Chapman. So these are Perutz's words. Quote, Pike handed me a report that he said he had found hard to understand. It was by Herman Mark, my former professor of physical chemistry. As an expert on plastics, he knew that many of them were brittle when pure, but could be toughened by embedding fibers such as cellulose in them, just as concrete can be reinforced with steel wires. Mark and his assistant stirred a little cotton wool or wood pulp, the raw material of newsprint, into water before they froze it, and found that these additions strengthened the ice dramatically. And I love this comparison to actual building practices such as embedding rebar or steel wires within concrete when you're making a building. The fibers or wires running longitudinally through the material help prevent rupture. But so this stuff, this mixture of frozen water and wood pulp, would come to be known as Pikrete in honor of Jeffrey Pike, aka Pike's Concrete. And there's an anecdote about the discovery of this material and trying to sell it up the chain that Collins reports, and he gets it from the book Pike, the Unknown Genius, published by Evans Brothers in London in 1959. It's a biography of Jeffrey Pike written by David Lampe. And the story goes like this. So one day, Prime Minister Winston Churchill gets a visit from Lord Mountbatten while Churchill is at the Prime Minister's country house known as Chequers. And reportedly, when Mountbatten arrived at the house, the staff informed him that the Prime Minister was in the bath. He can't talk right now. He's having a good scrub. And Mountbatten was like, good, perfect, take me to him. So Mountbatten charged into the bathroom. And then from here, I'm going to read from Collins's version of the account. Quote, I have, Mountbatten explained, a block of new material that I would like to put in your bath. Mountbatten opened his parcel and dropped its contents between the Prime Minister's bare legs in the water. It was a chunk of ice. Rather than bellow at his chief of combined operations, Churchill stared at the ice intently, and so, standing by the bathtub, did Mountbatten himself. Minutes passed, and they still looked into the steaming depths of bathwater before them. The ice was not melting.
This is such a great moment in global history right here. I mean, it certainly it has to be up there for like great nude moments.
Oh, yeah.
In world history. You know, just dealing with, say, like the non-saucy moments in world history that matter that also combined involve nudity. Like, this has to be it. Naked Churchill in his bath, beholding this floating block of wonder ice.
Well, I'm not sure he was naked. Maybe Churchill bathed in a tuxedo with tails and a top hat. You never know.
Well, maybe. But then we're just in weirder territory.
But so, yeah, here we have Picrete. And I should say that I'm a little confused about the timeline here, because some sources I was looking at report that the Picrete thing came in like early 1943. But Collins puts this story in late 1942. So there might be some questions about the timeline here. And so I do wonder about the veracity of this story. But I have no reason to believe that it's fabricated, and I want to believe it's true.
Well, I don't want to dispel this mental image, so we're going to take a quick break. Keep this in your head, and then after a word from our sponsors, we will return and bust open the Picrete.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone, this is Molly and Matt, and we're the hosts of Grown Up Stuff How to Adult, a podcast from Ruby Studio and iHeart Podcasts.
It's a show dedicated to helping you figure out the trickiest parts of adulting.
Like how to start planning for retirement, creating a healthy skincare routine, understanding when and how much to tip someone, and so much more.
Here's a clip from an upcoming episode featuring the weekly home checks, Keyshawn Lane, that you won't want to miss.
A common mistake that a lot of people do, they use fabric softener when it's not so great for your clothes.
Should we never be using fabric softener?
No, you should not ever be using fabric softener.
Wow.
It leaves a deposit on our clothes, which is also left in the machine. And it also makes the clothes highly flammable.
Wait, what?
Yes. What you want to do instead is just use a quarter cup of vinegar.
And that'll make them softer?
That'll make them softer. And if you wanted some kind of scent, you can use essential oils.
Wow, wow, wow. Catch new episodes of Grown Up Stuff How to Adult every other Tuesday on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Grown Up Stuff.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and Vlastar runs the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So here we are at the birth of Picrete, the potential solution to the iceberg aircraft carrier problem.
That's right. They realized that this was an avenue forward. This was a way we might be able to strengthen the ice so that we could do all the amazing things that we want to do with it. So they experimented. Different pulp ice combinations were tried. You know, the different pulps, wood pulp, rocks, other materials put in there. But they ultimately found that all you needed was as little as 4% pulp, and you would experience a huge upgrade in durability compared to regular ice. Basically, these embedded materials prevented cracks in the ice from advancing. So, I mean, basically, you could think of it as, you know, a crack starts, and instead of being able to eventually vein its way through an entire block and bring it to pieces, it could only go so far before it encountered something to stop it.
So if you were going to make a wall out of ice, Picrete would be a better candidate than regular ice.
Yes. Yeah. As Thompson points out, it's not that it would make it. I mean, it makes it more durable. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that it would be invincible. It would still fail, but it would fail in a much more predictable fashion. And that's also why Thompson ultimately points out that if you're Brandon the Builder, the legendary Brand, mm-hmm. if you're looking to build a giant wall of ice, even with the help of some magical beings, doing something like Picrete would be your best option for building that wall.
Yeah, so I was reading Perutz's reports about these experiments with Picrete, about like the optimal type of wood pulp to use, the optimal amount of wood pulp and suspension of water to use. So it looks like they usually ended up using spruce or pine wood pulp that's ground up by machines. And this is the pulp that ultimately would become the pages of a newspaper in another context. When in liquid form, this mixture has interesting properties. Like a 5% suspension is sort of porridge-like. It's kind of like oatmeal. But a 10 to 15% suspension is more like a sponge. And when you freeze it, you get this resulting matrix of water, ice, and saturated wood fiber that becomes extremely tough. You can bash it, shoot it. It tends to hold together very well. There's a famous story of Lord Mountbatten taking out his pistol at a meeting of allied commanders to shoot a block of ice. Of course, when he shoots the block of ice, it shatters all over the place, and then shoot a block of Picrete to demonstrate the difference. And apparently when he shot the Picrete, the bullet ricocheted and grazed the pant leg of an American admiral in the room.
Oh, my goodness.
There are also reports that the people outside heard the shooting. They had not been warned, and they were like, who's shooting in there? Is there an assassination going on? But no, it's just dashing Lord Mountbatten with his pistol, shooting at materials to make a point.
Wow, this is so weird. And it's, again, I don't think this has ever been in a film. I had a Russian history professor once who was fond of pointing out that, you know, you'll see some movies about, for instance, the Eastern Front during World War II. Mm-hmm. But you're always going to see the same stories, the same particular stories told time and time again. When there are so many additional, equally interesting and many times strange stories that are spread out across that entire theater of the war. Mm-hmm. And likewise, when you look at like all the things that are going on during this period, you have stuff like this that just, for some reason has a way of falling through the cracks.
Yeah, totally. And it still keeps getting weirder. So another thing about this project is that it had to be very secretive. I mean, this is top secret military research at the time. So you had people making just big troughs and buckets of wood pulp mixed with water. And this is like the same level of secrecy where people are trying to create a death ray or something. Apparently they took out refrigerated rooms under a London meat market. I think it was Smithfield's market. They converted this into this top secret experimentation and manufacturing space for pycrete. And Perut says that a lot of people working on pycrete research had no idea what this was going to be used for. Like, they were kept in the dark in order to maintain, you know, OPSEC. But a few of the things they determined in their research, one was that an ideal amount of wood pulp to make pycrete is about 14%. So, you know, like 86% water, 14% wood pulp. They also found that temperature can matter a lot. This material, a lot of the good things about it become less reliable as it warms up. And so in order for it to have its optimal features, it really needs to be kept at about negative 15 degrees Celsius. But if you keep it cold, it is much stronger than regular ice. It behaves much more predictably than regular water ice. Perut says that it gave results which were reproducible to within about 25%, plus or minus 25%. And the wood pulp actually decreased the brittleness of ice so much that Perut says that pycrete was ductile and could even be machined on a lathe. So ductile means that it can be stretched out into a wire. So that's definitely showing you a material that is tough and not brittle.
So we said we'd come back around to just how torpedo-proof pycrete would be. In researching this, they found that a torpedo would, upon impact, dig in about 60 centimeters, and then it would crater out a 4.5-meter area in the pycrete. So they figured, okay, we would need to have a 9-meter-thick hull. That would do the work. And then, of course, also to accommodate the aircraft, as I think we already mentioned, it would need to be like 600 meters long and 60 meters wide.
So huge again.
Yeah, enormous. So basically, this is the sort of durability that would prevent a U-boat from being able to like sneak in, pop off a torpedo, and just bring the whole thing down.
Right. It was supposed to be sort of like a floating fortress or a floating island. It would just be, for practical purposes, invulnerable.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean it was without problems. So, like, one of the things that they observed while they were testing the material properties of pycrete was that pycrete is, like other ice, subject to something we mentioned earlier, creep.
Ah, yes.
Creep is, again, the slow deformation of materials under pressure over time, the slow flow. So if you put a heavy load on a slab of pycrete, it's not nearly as susceptible to cracking and rupture as regular ice is. But if you just leave that load there, the slab will probably sag over time, which is not something you want to happen if you're going to be parking aircraft on it and stuff like that. So research revealed times and periods of creep were different for different substances, depending on, you know, the kind of wood pulp, different percent suspensions and all that. But the temperature constraint was, again, very important. They determined that negative 15 degrees Celsius was like the highest permissible working temperature. If it gets warmer than that, this boat is going to be in trouble. Okay, so eventually in 1943, the naval engineers decided, yes, pycrete is strong enough. We can make this. We can do it. So get to work constructing our Berg ship. Perutz reports that they wanted to have a working prototype that would be ready within the next winter season. And then soon after that, a fleet of them, which would be ready for a possible invasion of Japan. And Perutz notes that to many engineers, this seemed impossible. But then he puts it within the context of the whole sort of like war orientation. And Perutz writes, quote, "In retrospect, this may seem the obvious verdict, but it must be remembered that the Berg ship plan was only one of several apparently impossible engineering feats conceived during the war, e.g. the atomic bomb, and that the question was not so much one of absolute feasibility, but rather of whether the ultimate strategic advantages to be gained by the Berg ships were in proportion to the expenditure of manpower and materials involved in their construction. In fact, I think that had not the course of the war and the state of our armaments changed, the Berg ship could have been constructed. So that's Perutz's opinion. He thinks, you know, if things hadn't changed and made it not so rewarding, we could have done it.
Yeah.
Just a couple more physical details about the proposal that I thought were very interesting. One is that this hypothetical giant Berg ship would have had a waterproof skin on the outside to help insulate the pycrete, but then also the material would have to be cooled with artificial refrigeration, right? Because they've got to keep it at negative 15 degrees Celsius or colder. So they would have an air conditioning system on the aircraft carrier made of pycrete to refrigerate the pycrete, and it would be blowing compressed air on it to keep it cold. But the downside is, if you think about that, oh man, if the air conditioning system breaks, then your ship could start melting and lose structural integrity. Though another good thing about pycrete, as we mentioned earlier, is that it melts more slowly than regular ice. So you'd still have a bigger window of time than you would on a regular iceberg.
I can't help but be reminded of there was an old Disney cartoon with like Donald Duck and the nephews battling each other in like an epic snowball fight. Do you remember this one?
Yeah.
And Donald Duck, I believe, builds like a warship out of ice. And he's, you know, devastating his nephews until they have like a flaming bow and arrow, which seems a little violent in retrospect. But they fire that into his ice ship and then melt it. And it like melts into the shape of like a duck skull.
Brutal.
Yeah, it's weird stuff.
OK, but a couple more questions about this aircraft carrier. Like, if you're going to take this idea seriously and try to actually build it, first of all, where do you freeze it? You know, remember that Winston Churchill wanted to let nature do the job. That was his quote. That was the cheap boss idea. But it quickly became apparent that this was just not really feasible. There was just nowhere they could find on Earth where you could feasibly let natural cold freeze this thing in place. It just wasn't going to work. So instead, they turned to some artificial construction ideas that would be based in Canada. Perutz writes, quote, "The locality eventually selected for building the prototype was Corner Brook in Newfoundland," where I said it right this time.
You did. And I was more reacting to the fact that I've been to Corner Brook. I barely remember it, but I was a child at the time. But yeah, I've been to Corner Brook.
Oh, what's it like?
Like I say, I barely remember.
Oh, okay.
I think I got to get a toy at a gas station or something there. Like, that's of course the only thing I remember because I was a child, but I remember the name.
Well, it sounds lovely. And it sounds cold because Perutz said the average daily temperature was negative 5 degrees Celsius. I guess this would be in the winter time, but it could be expected for 100 days straight. And there you would have protected waters of sufficient depth in order to try to build one of these things. Now, Perutz also says, even though it wasn't made of steel and didn't require steel like a regular warship would, it is still a huge material investment. One ship alone would require 1.7 million tons of pycrete material.
Wow.
Where can you make that much? Perutz argues that this alone would have required a refrigerated plant of something like 100 acres or 40 hectares. And this would take away from other industrial needs of the Allied war effort.
Yeah, you can't build that out of ice. You're going to have to build that out of metal and wood, right?
Yes. And so these difficulties we've been talking about, along with other changing circumstances, ultimately caused the Allies to abandon the plan for Berg ships in 1944. And the other circumstances were a range of things. One was that that airplanes themselves started to get increasing flight range.
Yeah. Just our aviation technology increased enough to where suddenly those distances weren't insurmountable anymore.
Yeah. And Perutz actually says that a lot of these changes started around 1942, the same time this project started. But eventually you could get land-based airplanes out far enough over the ocean to provide sufficient air cover, even if they had to launch from bases on land. And other things were the acquiring of additional bases on land. So like a couple of sources mentioned the fact that Portugal granted the Allies use of the Azores in the Atlantic, and this helped them reach farther out into the ocean. So there's that on the one hand. And then on the other hand, some changes in airplanes also meant that you needed even more runway space than you had before. So it would mean that you could build this 600 meter long floating runway, make this huge investment to build this thing. And then a lot of the new planes that you want to launch can't even get off of it because now that's not long enough for them. They've just got to be launched from the ground still. So as you're accommodating what kind of platform you can get out into the middle of the ocean, the planes are requiring more and more platform all the time. Finally, Perutz also notes that, quote, the island hopping campaign of the American forces in the Pacific had been successful beyond expectation and had made an eventual invasion of Japan appear feasible without large floating air bases.
So just in general, in this short amount of time, the world had moved on and was leaving the idea of the bird ship behind it.
Right. So we never got to find out if this idea could really be achieved because it just sort of became obsolete as the war progressed. But there's an interesting note that Perutz makes about this project as a contribution to ice science in general. He writes, quote, "Nevertheless, the volume of first-rate data produced within a period of 6 months in this country and in Canada under the pressure of war far exceeded the total volume of reliable work that had been done before on the mechanical properties of ice itself."
So war, what is it good for? I still think the song is correct. Absolutely nothing. But I guess you could make an argument for the advancement of our understanding of ice.
Well, it makes you wonder, like, what if we just put the amount of priorities on regular scientific research that we put on that research when it's necessary to win a war?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember Neil deGrasse Tyson making this point about space exploration. I forget which book this was, but he was basically saying, hey, you know, if we really want to get serious about space exploration, we need to fake the existence of an extraterrestrial enemy, because that, if we can get the war machine behind it, if we can get that kind of political and public capital supporting it, you know, then we could do all sorts of things.
Unfortunately, I kind of agree. I guess this is the Ozymandias theory from Watchmen, right? But
yeah. But
I think part of the problem is a lot of what you would end up researching was the creation of newer, more powerful weapons, which are maybe not exactly what we need.
Right. I think we've discussed this before in terms of rocket science under the Third Reich. You know, there's often this sort of fantastic misconception that there is, there's these great advancements in space technology, and there was a secret moon base that the Nazis had, that sort of thing, the Nazi space program. But and really, you do, and of course, you did have a lot of brilliant minds working at the time. But like so many other brilliant minds during this global war, they were sucked into that black hole of global conflict. So their value to these nations that they were serving were just boiled down to warfare interests. Like, oh, you're good at rocketry. Well, can you make a rocket bring death to this country? Oh, you know about how ice works. Well, that's great because we're trying to build a massive weapon out of it.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we don't want to downplay that. Like in Germany, there were actually advances made in rocketry that were later put to peaceful uses. But the uses they were put to primarily during the war were to rain hell down on England and other allies. But so anyway, that's the end of the historical Pykrete story, you know, that the project came to an end. And there has not been a lot of serious investigation of Pykrete, certainly not at that scale since then. People have done little projects where people have built structures out of Pykrete and stuff, and that's interesting. And in fact, there have even been like Mythbusters and some other TV shows kind of like this. I think there's one in Britain called Bang Goes the Theory that have tested out small boats made of Pykrete. I know in the Mythbusters episode, they tested the mechanical properties of Pykrete, like trying to drop it from certain heights and smash it. And they confirmed the kind of stuff that Perutz had already been saying, that like a frozen block of water saturated wood pulp did indeed melt a lot more slowly than an equivalent sized block of water ice. It was also a lot more structurally sound when dropped from a height of about 6 feet. A frozen block of water would, you know, shatter into a million pieces, just like you would expect. But a block of frozen Pykrete would break maybe in half, maybe lose a piece here and there, but it was not nearly as brittle as the water ice alone. And then in the Mythbusters investigation, they actually make something they end up calling super piecrete, which is instead of using wood pulp in its, very small shaved up form, they use whole sheets of newspaper frozen within the ice. And the sheet newspaper piecrete was super strong. It was extremely resistant to shattering.
Oh, man. If you use a newspaper that has really strong journalistic integrity in there... It's going to hold up even more.
One other just sort of popular media thing I came across was that there is a YouTube channel called the Hydraulic Press Channel. Have you ever watched this?
No, but I'm assuming it's like the old David Letterman bit, right? Where he would take different things and put it in a hydraulic press.
Oh, okay. It's exactly that. It's just some people.
Oh, okay. Excellent.
I did not know that was a David Letterman thing. Yes.
Oh, yeah. This is like the old David Letterman show. They would do that. Yeah.
That's great television. And I got to admit, I start one of these videos up. I'm probably going to watch it to the end. I want to see what it looks like.
And you know why? Again, it's James Cameron's fault because of Terminator 1.
Yes.
Because as children, we watched that scene where the T-800 is crushed in the hydraulic press, and it made an impact on it. It burned into our psyche, and there's just something about a hydraulic press we can't look away.
Yeah, so the Hydraulic Press Channel, they tested out some piecrete, regular sawdust piecrete, and they found, of course, it does not shatter the way you would expect ice to shatter. Instead, I would say that it seems to, under extreme pressure, it seems to first kind of melt around the edges and then crumble ultimately. I mean, under much more pressure than it takes to crush a similar amount of ice, it ultimately kind of crumbles in a sticky looking way, kind of like a crumbly block of feta cheese. Can you picture this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I can.
Picture something that looks like a cross between crumbly feta cheese and maybe like orange juice concentrate. And so it's just kind of peeling off in pieces like that. They also try some newspaper mush piecrete. This does also kind of a melt and a sticky crumble. The pieces are softer, less frozen. And then they end up using what looks to me like toilet paper. I'm not sure. They call it sheet paper. But this one's got a really interesting texture. It's worth looking up. It kind of flakes when crushed, and the flakes are still, they demonstrate very large and strong. So it looks like something that would be soft and melt in your hand, like a piece of butter or cheese. But then when you pick it up, it's like solid. You can bang it against stuff. Anyway, very interesting material and something that I think you can quite easily make or make a version of at home.
That's right. I mean, ultimately, people can make their own piecrete at home after listening to this show and then tell us about how it went.
There was a thing in that Cabinet magazine article by Paul Collins where he quotes a professor named Erlen Schulson, director of the Ice Research Laboratory at Dartmouth College. And Schulson is trying to answer the question of why modern people don't make better use of piecrete in light of its benefits. And he just says, I don't really know why it has languished in obscurity. It seems like something that could actually be useful for a lot of things, but for some reason, people have done things here and there, but it does not seem like it has been taken up in a large way.
So that's the past and the present. We might well wonder about the future of ice-based building. And I was looking around a little on this, and I ran across The Uses of Martian Ice, a paper by Charles S. Cockle, published in the Interdisciplinary Science Reviews. This is back in 2004. Cockle writes, quote, Martian polar ices could be used as a shield by human explorers. By covering a research station with ice, high-energy solar particles could be absorbed, protecting explorers from potentially damaging radiation exposure. Finally, Martian ices provide a substratum over which scientific and exploratory expeditions could traverse on their way to deep field sites and the geographic poles themselves. Martian polar ices have the potential to open a new and unique chapter in the long relationship between humans and ice. So that's a neat idea, like the idea of building structures out of ice, and it sounds like highways of ice on the red planet.
Sure, and I think this has been proposed by other people in the past. I can't remember where, but I know I've encountered the idea of using ice or even a mixed up matrix of ice and other fibers, kind of like piecrete, to build structures potentially on like asteroid surfaces.
Yeah, so there may be some potential for piecrete there. I was looking around for some more takes on this, and I came across an interesting concept, the Mars Ice House Project, which is a concept that won at the 2015 New York Makers Fair. They have a really sleek website at marsicehouse.com. But this is a concept from Search, that's the space exploration architecture, and Clouds AO, that's Clouds Architecture Office, and it basically is, the idea is to have robotic machines 3D printing buildings and structures out of ice on the Martian surface. And they claim that, quote, in consultation with our team's expert scientific advisors, astrophysicists, geologists, structural engineers, and renowned 3D printing experts, we have achieved positive experimentation with one-to-one ice printing and successfully analyzed structural models. Now, obviously, there are a lot of caveats here related both to the properties of ice and the particular challenges of the Martian environment. But I think it's really a thought-provoking concept. You know, imagine ghost cities made out of ice built on Mars by autonomous laborers.
Yeah. Or robots build structures that nobody's in yet. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, just like weird, like geometric igloo cities on Mars. And I don't know that they really get into the Pie Creek concept as much, but it makes sense that could be a part of it as well.
I think part of the secret to this is don't let Cohagen buy up that city. He can't get in early because he's not going to give the people the air.
That's true. He is stingy with the air. But the ice, up for grabs, I guess. All right, so there you have it. Piecrete, ice, walls of ice. Hope you enjoyed this journey. It was a fun one to go on with you. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Do you have thoughts on ice itself, on Piecrete? Have you ever made Piecrete? Do you just have any feedback on the various contemplations regarding like 80s and 90s cinema that we touched on? You know how to get in touch with us. Joe will provide the details here in a second. As always, if you want to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you know where to find us. Wherever you get your podcasts, there are a million places to get us out there. All we ask in return is that if you have the ability to rate, review, and subscribe, do that, because that helps us out.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.